thanks. Actually, the Wilson Processing Project is much more, and I wish I had time to describe it. There was a presentation at the Music Library Association conference in Memphis back in February, and I can probably talk to you individually about it, but I do quite a bit of other things than what I'm talking about also. But I enjoyed the introduction. I have a few prologue statements here. I'll try not to take up too much time and panic Patrick. But I do want to say, first of all, I've been trying to get my 11-year-old daughter to teach me PowerPoint, the way they use it in their fifth grade class, but to no avail. So this is a monomedia presentation, no visuals. That's not a knock on all the other presenters, but I'm challenged in that way. I also want to correct the title. The abstract was done months ago. The 80,000 LPs is now more than 90,000. I'll give you the exact number when I get it to in the text. The mileage is correct. I used MapQuest to measure the distance from the Library for the Performing Arts on 65th Street to the Annex, where I work on 43rd Street, and then from the Annex to Dublin, Ohio, where OCLC is, and I doubled it. This will be significant once you hear my presentation. I also wish to give a bit of an apology for the fact that I'm going to be reading from text. I prepared this. I was going to do it just from notes off the cuff, but that version was an hour long, and I only have half an hour, so I figured writing it down would cut out a lot of the ers and ahs. I also unfortunately had to cut out about more than 40 years of history of how this collection of LPs came to be and how it was cataloged or attempts to catalog it. Don McCormick allowed me to interview him, and it's very interesting, but you're not going to hear about it. It's sort of like in the Mikado, Coco says to Nanki Poo, after he's going to be beheaded, there will be lots of fireworks and general rejoicing. You won't see them, but they'll be there anyway. Well, the history's there. You're just not going to hear about it. I do thank Don and apologize. I also want to thank Karen Sue, the head of cataloging for New York Public Library, and also Richard Kramer, who's the head of database maintenance and authority control, who also spent time allowing themselves to be interviewed. Some of their information did get into the presentation. One, I guess, advantage of having a written text is I'll be able to make it available. I don't have it to hand out now, but I can give you information later how to contact me, and I plan to either put it up on the web or I can email it to you. So now on to our regular scheduled program. Aside from the 40 years of history that you're not going to hear, the story of how the bulk of Rodgers and Hammerstein Archive of Recorded Sound, which is a division of New York Public Library's Library for the Performing Arts, how it came to be cataloged starts in 2001. That's when a project for the processing of the backlog of archival material at the Library for the Performing Arts, LPA, was set up. This project was the subject, I already told you that. Okay. When R&H was approached to see how they wanted their part of the budget, because this was spread out over all the divisions of the Performing Arts Library, how they wanted to spend their part of the budget, they considered a backlog of unprocessed archival unique recordings. They considered cleaning up the infamous Riegler Deutsch Index. I won't get into that. And they also considered their LP collection. Only a tiny portion was in their online New York Public Library's Catnip online catalog. With no hesitation, he tells me, Don McCormick chose the LPs. This was just too good an opportunity to pass up. These LPs exist in many groupings, some with class marks and card catalog entries, some with cards and no class marks, just label and issue number, some in a flat database called Atlas, which is only available to the staff there, some with no trace anywhere, just sitting on the shelves, filed by label, you know, record store style. Armed with a Schwann, a Bielefeld, or some sort of discography, one could find things with or without the assistance of the card in online catalogs if they happened to be in the closed stacks down in the basement, but it was a crapshoot. The totally uncataloged group, which I referred to, was estimated to be around 65,000 items. And this was to be the object of an all-out cataloging assault. Since this processing project did not have a dozen or so catalogers on staff, they were mostly archivists processing paper collections, it was seen that this would have to be an outsourcing project, for better or worse. The library had had some previous experience with outsourcing to OCLC in the past, so Karen Sue, who I mentioned earlier, and Cynthia Clark, the library's head of technical services, started to discuss matters in earnest with OCLC in the spring of 2002. Soon, David Brown, the head cataloger for R&H, was brought in to make sure that the specifications reflected enough of what the division considered important for providing access, given the realities of the physical setup and locations of the listening room and stacks. They're several floors apart. The primary focuses were on providing a maximum of access points by requiring full contents notes. If you know Mark speak, that's the 505. Composer analytic entries for classical compositions, the 700 with the 12-1-2 indicators. I won't get too much into the cataloger speak. And the music publisher and alternate numbers, which are 04 or something. This is important because there's more than one way to find a recording, not just from the content. Sometimes you're looking just from a label perspective. It's also vital to include a 500 note indicating the location of liner notes or other accompanying matter that were noted in the cataloging. Again, as I said, the liner notes are stored on the third floor. The records are in the basement. It's really important to know where that matter is if a patron actually wants to read what it said in the notes. This draft agreement went through at least three revisions, and the final document was ready and dated December 16th, which you all know is Beethoven's birthday. Though it took the then head of the research libraries until the 31st of January 2003 to get around to signing it, which point my involvement increased dramatically. The drawing up of the agreement was almost entirely in the hands of tech services, upper management, and the cataloging staff of R&H. But the carrying out of it all was pretty much in my lap from this point on. This was drawn into high resolution when the head of the archival processing unit I worked for first went on a 3-month maternity leave and then quit shortly after she came back. This would be a great topic for a presentation on how things go amazingly wrong and still turn out all right, but that's not my topic. Fortunately, the project manager knew someone with experience shipping vinyl and got enough information from them so that she was able to order several thousand custom-made cartons before she unexpectedly left. I say fortunately, since this is an area I really have no past experience or knowledge of, and I had a lot of other things on my mind at that point. So I was glad to have the boxes taken care of, which is just about the only thing that was. Now I went about setting up a processing unit in the basement at LPA using a rotating crew of technical assistants. Now, again, I don't work for LPA or in LPA. I work in a warehouse called the Annex on 43rd between 10th and 11th Avenue by the railroad tracks. I wrote up some guidelines. I have a few copies of this I can hand out, not enough to put on a table or anything, but if you actually want to see what I wrote, I can give you a copy. One of the first things to do was remove shrink wrap from a lot of these things. A large quantity just came straight from the record labels, never played, never removed from the shrink wrap. And since we were going to have to do a certain amount of class marking and labeling, we weren't going to put the labels on the shrink wrap. So lots of box cutters were distributed. I told the staff to keep an eye out for duplicates. They were sort of on their own to determine what were duplicates. I mean, it's obvious to most of us, but this crew really did not know anything about records. So I hoped that they would do something. I also told them to look for out-of-scope material. That included language instruction. That was probably the largest category, you know, teach yourself Hebrew or whatever. Sound effects records. I don't think that's considered performing arts, although it could be. Turntable and cartridge alignment records. Music minus one. Though as music, it didn't fit into the environment of a listening room in a research library. Spoken word with that was really absolutely in no way possibly conceivably performing arts. And I pretty much tried to include almost everything that was spoken word, even if it was just somebody such as myself standing in front of a microphone talking to people. I considered it's performance. And I also assumed that if I separated it out, sent it to another division somewhere downtown, it would never get cataloged. So practicality, I said, we have the money, we have the project, let's get it cataloged, even if it's not, strictly speaking, performance. They were instructed to put class mark labels on each, in a specified location, each jacket or set container. These were just plain old Avery labels, so they had to put archival library tape over them because Avery labels fall off after 5 years, guaranteed. They did some minor maintenance. If there was no inner sleeve, they replaced that. There's no jacket. They had we had archival heavyweight paper sleeves to put them in. Sometimes, if the text that was to be stored on the third floor was the inner sleeve, you know, as on most, a lot of pop albums, you know, have lyrics, that was removed. So, other texts were also removed and class marked. But if it was the inner sleeve, that obviously had to be replaced. Occasionally, the jacket was there, but it was totally falling apart, and we could encapsulate that if necessary. I had to teach them what was really accompanying material. 8x10 glossies were not really, not considered, you know, something that they wanted to make available. Letters from, you know, publicity agents, programs that were just stuffed in the sleeve, clippings and that sort of thing. All really interesting, but not really considered by R&H to be part of what they wanted to be providing. It had to be really part of the packaging and usually text related. Okay, once this was done, this crew, I set up an Excel database with a separate field to identify certain things, just so we could know where everything was. And then we got it back and also helped identify if there was accompanying material when we got it back to go look for it and remove it. There was a field for what box it was in, and this actually turned out to be handy. I did have to track things down occasionally, and it was nice to know where it was. The label and issue number and the number of discs and the note, which, as I said, usually was saying libretto or something like that. I can't think of any instances where this really came in handy for other vital information, but it was there. This arrangement was very hard to oversee. I can say I was not really satisfied by the low level of supervision that was made necessary by my working most of the time in an office 20 blocks away. There's a lot more bad work than if I'd been on site, and supervising this had been my only responsibility. The work eventually did get done. There's nothing that happened that could be considered disastrous. Also might have gone better, as I referred to before, if any of the LTAs had any interest in the materials, but they showed no apparent familiarity or curiosity with what a label or any other component of an LP was or why it was significant. This, I just would have felt better if they knew what they were, you know, had some connection with what they were doing, but that's just sort of the nature of the way the library is set up. Once the unit was up and running, I started my personal deduping mission. We really didn't want to send out things twice because they would just get sent back. It was a minimal fee, but tried to avoid it. I tried to stay a few steps ahead of the people that were inventorying and packing. And my main target was mostly mono issues whose stereo version had already been cataloged. I really tried to do this. Lots of times I'd be too late. I'd see the mono had already been sent out, and when I saw the stereo, and we did have to send that out. So some things were cataloged twice. It wasn't possible. There was no 6-month or 12-month setup period. This basically was hit the ground running. Difficulty of locating duplicates was compounded by the various groupings of LPs that I alluded to briefly before. They'd been compiled in various different ways and various different ways of being identified. Yet more complexity was added by the 20,000 to 30,000 LPs that were either in boxes at the annex where I worked or en route to or from Dublin at some point in time, any point in time. And they were only identifiable from the not totally reliable Excel inventory. Sometimes it was just worth paying the $1.85, which I think was the fee for OCLC to send things back. If it was going to take too long to look for it, it's just, you know, don't bother. On the 1st of April 2003, 10,803 LPs, the first of six projected semi-annual shipments, were ready to go and were sent to OCLC in Dublin, Ohio. Did not go completely smoothly. The truck could not get anywhere near the loading dock, since the library's loading dock apparently was not designed with this sort of truck loading in mind. I don't know what they were thinking, but the cartons had to be carted out to Amsterdam Avenue by hand on trucks and loaded there. I had concerns about stacking these heavy cartons. You can imagine 75 to 100 LPs, try lifting those. I didn't want them stacked more than, I discussed with Don, more than two layers. Two layers I was a little nervous about, but three, you know, compression would start. I really wasn't sure what was going to happen, you know, once they were out of my sight. So I decided in the future to pack these on pallets and ship them to the annex and put them on pallets. And this worked out fairly well. Not long after the first batch left, we started to receive files of bibliographic records for our LPs back. Soon realized that the issue of quality control was a nightmare. These files are sent to us as soon as cataloging is done. The LPs come back in about 6 months. How do you check for accuracy? You don't really. You just look and look for mistakes. These files are flat text, not formatted for easy viewing or sorting, which also made a problem. They were just text files. I worked out some macros to manipulate them, but they were not a lot of use, except for inventory. Since the files are sent to something called Backstage by OCLC, there was some automatic authority control done, so that helped a little bit. Once we had these files, we made the decision to load them so they could be viewed by us. We didn't actually think the public would notice this, naively. The appearance of the records in our catalog actually was noticed. This was a mistake, because as soon as we loaded them, people wanted to listen to them. And the staff at R&H had to say, well, we don't have them. And so they called us. I called off the dog. We stopped loading. And I started creating a much closer tracking system where I could know when we actually had them back and reshelve them. Unfortunately, the first shipment that we got back en masse came back in randomized order. I don't know what they were thinking, but we'd sent them in Classmark order. They didn't come back that way. We had a major unpacking project at the annex, resorted 10,000 or so records, repacked them, sent them to LPA, unpacked them, shelved them. I mean, I screamed bloody murder, and it didn't happen again, fortunately. They were much better after that. The size of the original batch had been considerably overestimated. It turned out to be closer to 50,000 than 65,000. Also, the ratio of original to copy cataloging was way off. Original cataloging did not account for 40% of the total. This was thought was somewhere between 21 and 22%. It's meant amazingly, we were way under budget. We could expand our scope beyond the original bunch of totally uncataloged LPs. Card catalogs were scoured, and certain classes of relatively uncataloged LPs were pulled. Another sweep to locate the Classmark LPs that were not in that Atlas database I talked about earlier was next. Following this, another group of LPs without Classmarks but had label and issue cards was started. At the end of the third year, believe it or not, the budget still had not been completely spent. And the processing and cataloging these groups continued into a fourth year extension. The remaining LPs in that Atlas database were found. There were many more shipments. It kept going. As of May 12th, I think it was 91,039 that had been processed. And the last shipment's going out as soon as I get back to New York. I've been told by Don McCormick and others on R&H staff that there has been an increase in LPs requested since this project got underway, reversing somewhat of a decline in the years prior to this project. Frequently, these requests are for very recent additions to the catalog. In fact, we've had a number of cases where the LP is requested because it's been spotted in an OCL's WorldCat, which is, they go there right away as soon as they're cataloged. Doesn't matter that we don't have them or won't have them for many months. And I mean, did have one instance, though, where we had it, and it was way far from being shelved, but I was able to find it because of the inventory. It was an interview with Louise Nevelson, and an interesting record, not performance related, but I was able to find it. Somebody listened to it. And so the system does work. The process for the future is I'm trying to locate what else is left. This is a closed project, but I feel that we've gone this far. I think we've gotten the bulk done, and I would love to finish it. I'll find the funds somehow. That's the end of this part of the presentation. I sort of wanted to use this as a beginning, you know, if there's a few minutes left for some questions and answers, and I'm going to ask the question, at least for a start. How many people, you know, raise your hands if you either are responsible for a similar collection, a large LP or similar collection, or work in an institution that has one? Okay, now how many of you, of all the material you have, it's all in your online catalog? Okay, well, that reveals something. How many of you would like to have it in your online catalog? Yeah, of course. I'm curious to get some responses in terms of the average percent of what you have is in the online catalog. If any, how many of you, nothing is in the online catalog? Yeah, okay, well, that's, I'm not surprised. It's daunting, and I would say, how many of you feel like you have about 10 to 25%? And how many think you have more than half? A few. Well, you're lucky.
You're speaking just of LPs.
Yeah, I mean, 78s are another issue. I could go on that.
Well, 12 inch 45 and 10 inch 45.
Well, it's all interesting, and actually, I should say we did have 12 inch 45s were part of considered LPs for this project. We had 10 inch LPs, so those the numbers include that. Although I have to say the 12 inch 45s, there were maybe 40 that we had. Okay, I am curious though, does anybody want to volunteer how you provide access to your collections that are not in your online catalog? Sure.
Well, at Bowling Green State University, we, in our collection, we probably have over 300,000 LPs.
Yes.
Of which probably maybe 100,000 or so are catalogs. And we arrange all the uncatalogs in label and release number order. Mm-hmm. And we can use, you know, sometimes Schlon, but discography.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds a lot like R&H prior to this, although they had many different card catalogs. I wish I had had time to describe each of the intricate ways that different people, you know.
But the only thing we're caught up on are the 10-inch LPs. I think I have a stack of 2 inches high. Everything, all the 10-inch LPs in
the catalog. Yeah, I mean, sometimes it feels good to have some segment that you can say, we did that.
It's sort of
yeah.
Good. When you look at whatever else we've got, it's
ultra
daunting. But it's fun.
Oh, I'll say. Well, you're someone I want to talk to. I became aware of you after I got involved with this, and I'd love to hear your experiences. Yeah, I don't know, am I out of time? Well, thank you very much. I'll talk to you later.